Moncrief on News Talk.
Time for Moncrief's Murder Club, where Cassie Delaney guides us through some strange and diabolical cases. Afternoon, Cassie. Sorry.
Afternoon, Sean. How are you?
Welling up with emotion there already. Right. These are three really interesting cases. Two of them were kind of unsolved, but even the first one, there's all sorts
bizarre.
Of other questions I want to ask about. You want to ask about it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, people can be really stupid sometimes when they kill people.
The takeaway from today's episode is going to be that if you're going to do a murder, clear your cache. Like, delete your history, get rid of it. To have nothing
Absolutely.
There, in no skeletons in the closet, unless they're the bodies you're trying to get rid of. What we have today are three stories where the evidence has really stumped the investigators or has really exposed the people responsible for the crimes. The first one is, will actually kind of sound familiar to people because there was a conviction yesterday with a very similar case, but we're going to Nancy Crompton Brophy. And she was a writer, a blogger, and quite an eccentric woman who in 2018 murdered her husband, Daniel. So Daniel was a chef and instructor in the Culinary Institute in Oregon. And one morning on the 2nd of June, he arrived early to prep for the day, as he usually did. And not long after, he was found dead in the Institute's kitchen, shot twice. 63 years of age, no signs of a robbery, no obvious suspects standing in the doorway at the beginning. And this looked like just a very sad, very tragic kind of event. Nancy was playing the part of a grieving wife incredibly well. She spoke warmly about him. Friends described him as gentle and talented, and their relationship seemed like it had been a really good, healthy one. There was nothing again to indicate that they were spiraling towards murder. But investigators really dug deep here, and slowly a pool of evidence started to build against Nancy. And one of the elements of this case was in the years prior, she had written a post called How to Murder Your Husband on her blog.
Yeah.
Yeah. And pretty telling, pretty damning.
Now, she was, because she was kind of a crime novelist? She was all self-published.
She was kind of a romance novelist, a very eccentric woman, described by friends as being quite erratic, just a very imaginative person, I would say. But in this essay, she'd literally written, I spend a lot of time thinking about murder, but I don't want to spend any time in jail. So this essay became the kind of fixation of this case. But interestingly, it couldn't be shown to the jury because they would have said it just would have really swayed them too much. It was too inflammatory, too obvious. But the essay was kind of sensationalist. But the prosecution didn't have to rely on that. They argued that Nancy had a financial motive. She would have had money troubles and she stood to gain substantially from his life insurance policies. There was plenty of evidence to point her towards the crime, gun parts and a so-called gun ghost gun component. So this is where you kind of create a weapon that's really hard to trace. And the actual murder weapon was never found, but there was enough evidence to connect her to the crime. There was CCTV footage putting her outside the Culinary Institute. Her explanation was that she was researching for a new novel.
Maybe by buying a really dodgy gun.
Maybe based on her essay. It's real method, isn't it? Here, like actors who go deep, writers who go and kill their husbands to have a good plot of their new crime book. This is one of those cases that's kind of stranger than fiction. She insisted that she loved her husband. And the prosecution just said that her odd behavior was responsible, that explained her odd behavior. But they were able to convict her anyway. And in 2022, in May, a judge sentenced her to life in prison without the possibility of parole. She was 71 at the time of sentencing.
Oh, gosh.
I know.
Yeah, so that's never getting
out. But she said 71 years out of prison is a good old stretch.
Well, I suppose fair enough. Yeah. It's only one moment of madness not so well planned moment of madness. The jury, when they found out about the article she wrote, must have gone, for God's sake.
Yeah. But that would have been a great jury to be on, I'd say, because I imagine most crimes are pretty cut and dry and, very samey. But what's interesting about this one, I found, is if anyone's keeping up the news, there was a woman yesterday convicted, Corey Richens in Utah, who wrote a children's book about coping with grief after the loss of her husband. She wrote it for her children. And yesterday she was found guilty of his murder, which would have happened as this trial was going on. So I wonder, was she somewhat inspired, looked at Nancy and said, oh, she got a book deal out of it, or she got, she seemed to boost her blog anyway. I'll give that a whirl. Killed her husband too and wrote the children's book.
Now, and she always maintained her innocence, so we don't know, was it about money or...
She did. I mean, there was just too much pointing at her. The gun, yeah. You know, her search history, being outside the Culinary Institute, not having a good enough reasoning for that. And also, I think the fact that there was no signs of entry means that he would have let her in.
Yeah.
Because he knew her, loved her, opened the door and let her in, and then received two gunshots.
She was, she must have practiced then.
I'd say
so. She took him out in two shots.
Yeah. Well, she was in close range.
Yeah.
Very cold, isn't it?
Very cold. Right. Our second case, this is an Irish case.
This is an Irish one.
I suppose the first one, people, I think that sounds like a film. I think they did make a film out of this.
I mean, there's plenty of films like this where murderous women kill their husbands. I can give you a watch list if you want. It's a good genre. This one is an interesting one. This is an Irish case, but it's old now. We're nearly at 100 years since this happened. This is Larry Griffin, who was a postman in County Waterford. And on Christmas Day in 1929, he was out doing his rounds in the village of Strably, dropping off the Christmas cards.
The post office worked on Christmas Day.
And they would have the extra Christmas presents on his bicycle, cycling around. I mean, it would have been a good day. Imagine popping in, one for you, one for me, like popping in and getting his little jug of whiskey off them. So that's back then, like the postman was such a pivotal part of the community. He would have been in and out and would have been well known, part of the fabric of the place. So he would stop into chats, call into homes, and on Christmas Day especially, there would have been that kind of nice warmth and community air to it. So when he didn't come home that night, his wife Mary thought maybe he'd just gotten a little too drunk and slept overnight somewhere, that the roads would have been dark, would have made more sense for him to try and park up his bike and lay low for the night. But he still didn't come home on Stephen's Day. And then his bike was found kind of down a laneway between Stradbally and Kilmacthomas. And that's where it starts to get a little bit unusual, because his bike was found, but he was nowhere to be seen. So a massive, huge local search ensued. Local people were involved, the Gardaí were involved, fellow postmen, all joining in this effort, searching the surrounding area. They went through fields and roads and ditches, but they found nothing, no sign of at all. And very quickly, it stopped looking like a man who'd had an accident and started looking by something a little bit more egregious and dangerous. So they started looking at his last whereabouts and his last known moments.
Yeah.
And this is where the story starts to get a little bit hazy. Some people were talking about Larry being in the pub. The pub, of course, was illegally serving drink on Christmas Day. So whoever else was in the pub didn't want to get stung for being in the pub. And then the kind of witness accounts started to vary here. They were saying that Larry was drunk. Some people were saying that he wasn't. And then this kind of theory that there was an altercation in the pub started to arise. I think the idea was that he had been pushed over and banged his head on the fireplace, and that a couple of locals had covered it up. But the danger here was that a couple of locals were the teachers and the policemen and other people of authority in the community. So they were trying to, keep their hands clean of it. And initially, there were arrests here. There were a couple of people getting involved and a couple of fingers pointed. But once it got to trial, everything collapsed because the witnesses started to change their story in court. There was no clear testimony and the prosecution just fell apart. So no one was ever convicted. Nobody was ever recovered. And Larry Griffin still has never been found.
The body has never been found.
No, never been found. No obvious signs of, signs of a crime. It's just all the rumour mill and whispers around a little community village of what might have happened to Larry Griffin, our missing postman.
And they don't know how many people were in the pub that day.
I'd say there was a fair amount of people in the pub that day. Yeah.
So all the people in the pub who might have witnessed this might have communally agreed, we're going to keep this quiet.
That's the interesting thing, I think, about like these kind of small town community murders is, well, A, it brings people together, but B, it's like there's somebody who knows something and it's being covered up. You know, it's a real obstacle for the law. There's definitely somebody saw something and there's people who moved the bodies and someone put the bike down the laneway. So, they could solve it enough, but like tight-lipped people in a tight-knit community.
If anyone is listening in Stradbally, if you'd like to, text us in and let us know who actually committed that murder, that would be really helpful. We could crack a case that's over at nearly 100 years old. Right. Mm. And the third one, this is like an Agatha Christie thing.
Yeah.
In that, how did they even manage to get killed, murdered, apart from anything else?
Logistically, this one is mind-blowing. So this is one of those kind of classic, 1929, early 1930s Paris. Like, I imagine this one just being in black and white, everyone wearing like high neck trench coats, smoking long cigarettes. It's so romantic when you think about it. This is Letitia Thoreau, and this case is so interesting. She jumped onto the Paris metro at one stop, and by the time the carriage, which was completely empty when she jumped onto it, reached the next station, she had been stabbed and was dead. And that time period is like 90 seconds. Mm. So nobody knew who she was or who had murdered her or what the motive might have been. It was a single stab wound. And she had been, as I said, completely alone in the compartment. No one had seen anybody enter, and no one had seen somebody go from that carriage into another carriage during that 90 second kind of train journey. So it became the first murder ever on the Paris metro. It has that, like, that locked room mystery when someone's killed in a situation where, like, you just have no idea, like, the door was locked from the inside, no idea how they got in. Perfect fodder for a crime novel, like, as you said, an Agatha Christie. Like, and how do you actually do the crime in that period of time?
That sounds kind of very professional, which I suppose kind of ties into some of the stuff that was found out about her later.
Yeah, and naturally this would have been real, really, really big in the papers at the time, and it really stumped journalists and police. Because as well, people didn't really know who she was. So Letitia had been born in Italy and later moved to Paris with her family, was part of a larger wave of Italian migrants who came looking for work. By the time of her death, she was 29, widowed, and living what looked like a very ordinary life. So during the day, she worked in a factory, but as investigators began digging into her and who she might be, it was revealed that she had this kind of like secret life at nighttime. They discovered that she'd been working under a different name at a dance hall and had a kind of seedy edge to it. So they found that she had been making very discreet visits to the Italian embassy as well. Yeah, so they were looking for obvious possibilities. Maybe she had lovers, maybe she had secrets, maybe this was a crime of passion, maybe it was someone jealous or angry and they had followed it in. But then the more they investigated, the less that explanation seemed to cover it. When they widened the case, she looked less like a woman caught in a personal drama and more like someone moving through a dark political world. And this is where they start to suspect that potentially she had been a spy and that she had infiltrated a violent far-right secret organization in France that wanted to overthrow the Third Republic. So it looked like a very, and as you say, professional murder where she had been targeted and potentially killed in this very, very tight time frame. And someone, again, very sleek, very black and white, had come in with one little hit. And taken her out.
And who were the group that, what was the group that she
was? So the group were a notorious militant group, and they had said as well, when the investigation was going on, they started seeding out potential names. They claimed that the killing had been discussed. A whistleblower from the group came that the murder had been discussed at a meeting. But then that statement was later retracted and said that it had been made under pressure. This was a group that were interested in kind of installing an authority regime based more aligned with what was going on in Italy at the time.
Okay, La Cagoule.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd wonder if she was making visits to the Italian embassy, though. Mm-hmm. Was she helping them or was she spying on them?
I think she was giving them information based on what this sort of like paramilitary group were doing. This was like, not a sanctioned group of people. Mm. So going back and giving the information to the Italian authorities for good or bad, who knows?
Yeah.
Didn't end too great for her.
Yeah.
29 is no age either.
Okay, yeah. So, and so they were getting conflicting stories from La Cagoule as to, you know, what the story was. And how did the police proceed the investigation, or did they?
They couldn't really. So there was too much like unknowns happening here. She had a load of aliases. Her nightlife was coming into it. They were kind of pulling her character into it in a really interesting way that I think happens as well. When a female's at the centre of a crime like this, they really try and tear her apart and understand her, and she seemed like a very untrustworthy character. But it reached a conclusion by 1939, because with the outbreak of the Second World War, it was effectively dropped. It stopped being relevant in news headlines, it stopped getting the attention, and it eventually just kind of fell away. So there are files connected to this case, though, that have been sealed for decades, that are reported going to be unsealed in 2038.
Ooh.
Yeah.
You'd wonder why they sealed them for such a long time.
There could have been like sensitive government information there. Maybe some information that she'd been passing back to the Italian embassy, or somebody who was involved in power who wanted to be protected.
Yeah. And of course, the press at the time must have had a field day with this. Because you say, as soon as she has a secret, that means lovers. Yeah, or, you know, she's kind of,
I mean, a
dodgy,
lover, a female spy who's potentially having an affair. There's another film I'd watch now.
Good gosh. Cassie, thanks a million as ever. Cassie Delaney there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.